This is Icon Art Radio with Bill Teeple, Alan Cobb, and Donna Colby. We discussed in a recent show about the effect of original works of art on our minds, bodies, physiology, and our spiritual growth. I mean, I'm saying that now, but this is the effect that original work has on us. And there's a difference between looking at original art and looking at the magazine illustrations, even coffee table book fancy illustrated works of these masterworks, and even the slides that we see at the university art history classes don't convey the reality of these works. And you were just now remarking about the experience of original works and the effects on the viewer. So go over that again.
I was just reflecting that it's not even a matter of taste. Sometimes if I go to a large museum, I will have in my mind to go to my favorite artists, you know, and so in to get to those rooms where my favorite artists are located, I have to pass through other rooms by artists that I don't particularly think I like. And yet, as I'm going through those rooms, all of a sudden, I can be completely captivated by something I didn't think I liked. Because in looking through art books and, you know, various things, I thought, oh, you know, that's not my taste. It happened to me in the National Gallery in London recently, which I thought I love the Tate Gallery in London because it's all the modern artists, the 20th century and beyond. And the National Gallery has focuses on British art of an earlier, no, it has British art. Wait a second. No, that's the Tate. The National Gallery has older art.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really think I liked paintings, painters like Reynolds and, you know, Singer Sargent and all of that, Turner, that I'd only seen pictures of in books. And walking through that gallery, I was just like drawn to certain paintings and stood in front of particular paintings, maybe for as long as half an hour, of a topic that seemed kind of corny to me, you know, so a little girl standing in a garden or something like that. And yet I couldn't take my eyes off that painting. There was something that just happened to me in looking at that work. And so I think it's a very, like you were saying, how important it is to visit great museums. It's also important to go into the museum without prejudices in that you're holding on to about art, because even on one day, seeing works by this kind of artist that paints beautiful scenes in gardens, and then following along and seeing often disturbing works by Picasso or something, you know, the story of the Minotaur or his big painting Guernica, and then seeing abstract works, the big room in the Tate Gallery in London of the Rothkos that gives you a completely different flavor, but all of them speak to you in some deep way and leave you. When I leave those museums, if I'm not too intellectual when I'm going through them, I come out of the museum feeling like a bigger person and feeling like my whole perception of the world has changed in looking at these works of art.
Well, I think this is what turns people into art lovers. You know, it's one thing to appreciate a work of art. But as you say, to recognize, usually through having been moved by a couple of very specific works at some point, to recognize that art has that power. You know, most people haven't had that experience of being really blown away by an individual work. So they don't think that a picture on the wall can have that kind of power and influence. And that's, again, another reason for visiting museums, because if you're lucky, one of them will catch you by surprise when you're not looking. You know, you just walk into a room and suddenly realize, wait a minute, what is that? And then you go look at it, and you think, my God, someone actually painted that. And it there's no telling what it will be. It could be abstract or, you know, a picture of a cornfield, but it will, you know, there's one in there that will probably blow your mind. And then once you've had that experience a few times, you begin to realize that there's just no telling when it will happen again. And it's a wonderful experience.
Well, to some extent, that will be true of almost everything that's in there, especially historical. Mm-hmm. The museum people are still kind of sorting out what is great today.
Yeah.
Because it's really difficult sometimes to see the forest for the trees. So everything that's in there will stand out from the crowd, and that's why it's in there with contemporary works. But with the historical works, time has sorted it out.
Yeah.
And almost everything that's in there of a historical nature will have this impact to some extent. So if you go into the museum open to receive the gift that each artist is trying to give and has achieved over a lifetime's work, you'll be surprised how he'll take you into his world.
Yeah.
And you'll be blown away that someone did that and can enliven that point of view for you.
I would like to suggest a sort of Carlos Castaneda exercise for some listener who finds him or herself in New York City in the future, to go into the Metropolitan Museum with the assumption that upstairs in the big gallery rooms where there are hundreds of paintings and they're all great and there are often two rows of them going around the room, but go into those rooms and just walk slowly through them or in and around and back out if they're not through rooms, knowing that in each room, but certainly in at least one of those rooms, there's a painting waiting for you that will be your ally. And when you walk past it, it will reach out and find you. You don't have to look for it.
That happened to me, actually, when I was very young in high school. Mm-hmm. And I went to the Metropolitan Art Museum, again, kind of walking through quickly to go to the rooms where my favorites were. And there was a very large painting, and it wasn't even by somebody particularly famous. It was a painting of Joan of Arc. When she was a peasant girl, you know, mm-hmm. I guess when she had her initial call to perform this heroic act, and she was standing, leaning against a tree with like a little cottage behind her, wearing her peasant clothes. But the power in that figure and in her face was gripping to me. It was almost like me receiving my call to life to be, you know, something bigger than I was at the time, just to look at that painting. And every time I went back to the Metropolitan Art Museum in subsequent years, I would always go and stand in front of that painting and feel that same relationship. You know, it was like my painting somehow.
Yeah.
I had an epiphany of sorts around the paintings of Bonnard. I think I was a freshman in college, and I'd been to museums and art galleries, but I don't think I ever realized the transformative power of the gallery experience, the museum experience, until I had this experience. Like as a freshman in college, I went to the County Museum in LA, which is the main museum collection of works, and they were having this very, now I know it's a famous touring exhibit of the time by Bonnard, and I was transformed, but I was
fixed.
Transported is the word I'm looking for. I was transported to another world, which was his world, and I was awakened to what he was trying to communicate, and blown away.
Yeah.
And so it's riveted, I mean, to this day, it's riveted in my mind, the experience of those paintings. It was like I saw them yesterday, and they hold this power over me. So that one thing about once you've gone to the museum, then you can look at the books, and the books remind you of the real experience of the painting.
Right.
So they have more value than they did when you thought that homogenized, smooth plate in the book was the work of art. It's not. It's a reminder or a pointing towards or a glimpse of what was there. Mm-hmm. So now anytime I see even the crudest reproduction of a Bonnard in a book, it reminds me of that touchstone experience in my life. And I'm back there again. And I'm actually like you, I think it set me on the course to be a painter or a creator of original works.
Because it's like a land, like some magical land that you want to live in. When you look at Cezanne's apples, you know, there, and he was one of the prime examples for me of someone who you just can't get it from a book, because his layers are, Alan was talking last week about the layering that's done by oil painters to bring out this like underlying sparkle and luminosity when you look at the work, and you know, you just, and how you can't get that in a book. Well, Cezanne's layers are so subtle that even the first time you see it, if you take a hasty glance in a museum, you might not catch it, but even though you think, oh, that's a great painting, but the longer you stand there, the more you see, whoa, what in the world is going on here? And it's like entering a world, just like another, you said you experienced what Bonnard was trying to communicate. And I think it even goes beyond that to where the artist dwelt.
Well, that is exactly
the space where the artist
dwelt.
That's
exactly the situation. He is perceiving the world this way.
Yeah.
He's a seer. And the world is a magic reality for him. And the difference between a seer and an artist is that the artist is able to create a material work that holds that experience.
Yeah.
And he's not satisfied until his world lives in that material form. Mm-hmm. That's what drives him. That's his perfection that we talk about. It's really this sort of trying to drive into material, to a held form, the world that he's living in constantly. And when he's done it, then there's this, for him, it's the eureka experience. Aha, mm-hmm. I have found it.
You know what else, too, is for a true artist, it's only in his creative work, his or her creative work, often, that multi-layered, complex, rich inner world actually can come out. Because there's a lot of stories about artists whose actual everyday life, interacting with people and maintaining their home and all of that, was not that rich. It's the inner richness comes out. It's like they have to produce the art because that's the, in their life situation, that's the channel where they can be the most themselves. And so I think often if you actually had met one of these famous people in person, you may not get to know them as well as you can looking at their paintings.
Oh, no, it's a communion. It's a communication. Mm-hmm. And that's the goal of the process. I believe their eyes are seeing the world as this magic place, and yet they're in a very mundane, a lot of the artists have trouble dealing with the fact that there's these boundaries of mundanity that they have to function within, so the art really is their outlet. But I do think their eyes can't help but perceive the world as a magic reality. It's just that they're stuck in a very bound situation in the time and space that they're functioning in.
And we all, you know, whatever level of art we're capable of at this point, experience the same, that same thing to some degree. At least I know I have, and this difficulty in integrating what you feel when you're creating your paintings or your writings or something like that. And then 20 minutes later, when you go out to lunch with somebody, you feel out of sync somehow, because that fullness that you were experiencing in your studio, you kind of can't bring it with you as easily as you feel like you should be able to.
Yeah, I guess to me, it's the creative process is, although I think of it partially as a communication, I really see it, I respond to it more as a celebration. I'm building a speaker or making a strange, you know, sonic-oriented contraption because you can, because, you know, nature supports that particular unexpected embellishment on what happens if you just wait and watch what happens. And it gives you a chance to participate in the creative process of nature, not so much to, for me anyway, not so much to express my creativity as it is to find out what nature, who, you know, is responsible for my creativity, actually can do in a particular direction. So I'll look at something, it'll excite me, and I have to just, you know, go further in that direction and see what it leads to. And that often results in, you know, some, you know, strange tangible object that, you know, people can experience. And of course, then I'm thinking about what it will be like for them to experience it without having gone through all of the silliness that I had to go through between getting excited and actually having a finished work.
Well, I agree that the actual act of creating is assembling all the parts of creation that are before you and that are given to you as a possible field of action into something that feels, you know, just right, that expresses your feeling of rightness. The communication is sort of like icing on the cake for me. It's like, if you can drive it into manifestation and hold it, then there's the potential for another person to come along who wants to, that is searching for richness. Or, because a person can come to it in this like rich state. And so then there's a very interesting, like, connection that takes place between the two of you.
Yeah,
but there's also the person whose attention has never gone there, but he's open to experience. And so you open a whole doorway of experience for the person through the work. So there's different kinds of connections around the work. But at the moment of actual, so, and I consider those to be true levels of communication, as opposed to sort of what we think is what we're trying to have go on between us in everyday conversation. Oftentimes that's nothing but missing, you know? Or at least it's surface level. And in the art museum, or when we're communicating, like making music together or something, then there's this, like, this dive together into a very subtle place, which is really the glory of the realm of the arts, that this kind of deep connection and communication can take place. But alone in the studio, I think it's really between you and the work. And
in a sense, I'm trying to point at something and making something that isn't what I'm trying to point at, nevertheless helps to establish the direction of the pointing. And then when someone looks at it, with luck, they'll see what it was that I wanted to point at, or something like it, or something in that direction. And then, in a sense, I'm able to say, you see how great it is? You see how neat that is? And then it's like self-referral. I really want them to know what I'm, you know, what's exciting to me It's not so much that I want to have them be impressed by something that I made that's exciting. It's the fascination. It's the, you know, the like I said, the celebration of some quirky, weird little subtlety that really captivates me. And I want someone else to be able to say, yeah, I see what you mean.
Well, I think what I was talking about before, relating this experience in the studio and then going out to lunch and having it kind of be a letdown somehow, is I think there's a part of me that wants to carry on that exploration and celebration in ordinary life. In other words, I'm going from this richness that I've just experienced in the studio and going out to lunch and wanting to create a work of art out of the lunch experience with whoever it is, and want, and on some level want the other people that I'm with to participate with me and together to enter that same magical world of creating something bigger than all of us out of that lunch. And sometimes it happens. When you're least expecting it. But I think sometimes if you are expecting it or hoping that something magical is going to happen, it's the same danger that happens in your studio when you get too intentional in your work and you go in there thinking, you know, I want to feel like I did yesterday, or I want to feel like that artist I just read about yesterday has to be innocent.
And that's where we have to get out of the way. And that's why you're talking about, Alan, is exactly what I think it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
That you're delighting in the potentiality in the moment and working with it.
Yeah, I'm just trying to do justice
to it. And so if you get outside of that into some kind of trying or thinking about the effect of the in the future, then you're out of the zone for sure.
Yeah.
This other thing of how to make it happen outside of the studio, having lunch, was my area of concern for many years because I left the gallery world and the art world and the studio world to try to investigate this very area. How can that be the case in mundane activity? And what can I do to bring that about? I think that I was able to achieve a level of richness for myself in the everyday activity. And that still informs my activity to this day. If I get a little overworked and tired, it goes away a bit. But otherwise, I think that I'm living in the result of my practice every day. The richness, I'm inside a work of art all the time. And I'm talking about it in everything I do. Now, whether another person can come along, it's sort of how I'm able, I mean, it a little bit depends on how I orchestrate the moment. I mean, there's a point at which we never stop making art. Never Not an Artist, the Richard Tuttle thing. And I think that I'm always conducting a work of art. But I'm not consciously thinking, now I'm conducting a work of art. I think that it's sort of spontaneous. So this process that you're talking about of the studio state of mind and we're making an art that's in an innocent, just exploring the potentialities. I think I'm just actually working this out in my head right now as we speak. I think I'm doing that as a result of my practice for 15 years of the integration of art and life, which we have talked about in the past, and I would love to talk about more.
There's a wonderful book that I read several years ago by Thomas Moore called The Reenchantment of Everyday Life.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a great impact on me because he took specific categories of everyday life, working in your office, cooking food at home, even watching sports games, you know, mm-hmm. and explored them in light of the mysteries of life. And it was wonderful. It's wonderful just reading something like that to remind yourself that mm-hmm. There's so many layers of magic going on around us constantly when we're so too busy to pay attention to anything but what we've written down on our to-do list that day.
Those of us who have to-do lists.
But I used to be more like consciously trying to do this thing.
Yeah.
And I thought that was my art, this conscious, like making it into a work of art. Mm-hmm. And what I'm realizing now is that I've relaxed on that.
Yeah. That's
so that now critical. It's a very sort of quiet witnessing thing
mm-hmm.
of being aware that it's all this play
mm-hmm.
and illusion, and that that the ticking off the to-do list and even getting aggravated over the to-do list is all part of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of bounce back and forth between being fascinated by something and talking to someone about it and then getting into what for me is a highly creative process of explaining, as you all know, and having kind of sung the song in the explanation, I've really, in a sense, become completely absorbed in that particular blast of focused creativity. And then it's fascinating to remember to let go, and I'm done, or even before I'm done, when my audience is done. And then let the real magic, which is just reality, you know, kind of flood back into this strange, you know, verbal, you know, construct that I've created.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.